Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the chair of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, a key state this November, Ben Winkler. And remember, we love taking your questions. So write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Sleep Me, Magic Spoon, and Raycon in the show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James, stunning, spectacular, smashing. Choose your adjective. The Ukrainian army's rout of the fleeing Russians seems like a seminal moment. They recaptured thousands of square miles of territory in northeast Ukraine. You look at the map and it's just amazing. And I think we can agree, we've had some good guests on this show about this issue. The courage and resolve of the Ukrainian army, bolstered by the long-range missiles supplied by the United States, Joe Biden has been their greatest ally, has really, I think, shifted the tide of this war. Our guest a few weeks ago, remember Stephen Kotkin, the Russian expert, said if this offensive succeeded, it really could change the course of this conflict. And our friend Ann Applebaum of The Atlantic wrote, it's realistic to consider Ukraine winning the war now. And for Putin, James, it seems to me this is devastating. Another huge intelligence failure. Expectations were the major offense would come in the south, underscored the weakness of the Russian army and its generals. James, this is this is not over. This isn't going to end tomorrow. But this is good news.
It's superb news, and it is a ways to go, but is on the cusp of being one of the great foreign policy achievements any president's had in this century. In fact, I'm a little bit stunned to if this continues. Of course, we don't know. We always have to have the caveat. But boy, it doesn't look very good for the Ruskies. I mean, they're on a run, and you see the stories about the internal. People are just starting to attack Putin publicly without fear. I mean, there's something going on in the home front in Russia. I'm not sure what it is, but there is something going on. The criticism of Putin has just been blistering and public.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And that creates a real crisis in Moscow. How does Putin react? Does he mobilize? That's what he needs to do militarily, but that is extremely dicey for him politically. Does he escalate? Does he use weapons of mass destruction? And of course, most worrisome of all, would he resort to tactical nuclear weapons? That would be a disaster. But Ann said, again, Ann Applebaum, for all of his evil and miscalculations, and he's wrong, of course, he has acted rationally. Let's just hope that continues, and let's hope that Zelensky continues to push and move quickly, but also realizes at some point there has to be some kind of a settlement once Russians have been pushed out of everything they took since February 24th.
No, it's good news, and I don't think a lot of people were expecting this soon. Sometimes they're a pleasant surprise. I think this, so far, we can designate this as a pleasant surprise. Before we leave this, it's just stunning the number of right-wing Republicans that are actually pulling for Putin. It's just stunning. How could you pull for Putin? But ask Tucker Carlson or J.D. Vance or Donald Trump. I don't have an answer.
Well, because he's an autocrat or dictator, and they like that. I think that's a simple answer. Let's switch topics to back home. I want to ask you a question. Lindsey Graham this week, most Republicans all around the country have been running away faster than you can, say run from the abortion issue, scrubbing their websites, trying to fudge their position. Lindsey Graham this week announced that he was going to propose a federal ban on any abortions after most abortions, at least after 15 weeks. Do you think Lindsey, which our friend Chris Buckley calls squiggly tea biscuit, do you think he's a Democratic mole, maybe?
I think you're just stupid. Two people that at some point in their life were decidedly not a joke, all right, or have turned into a massive joke, Lindsey Graham and Rudy Giuliani. I can't think at one time, Lindsey Graham had a kind of a reputation, all right, cold faded. Maybe it was unjustified. I think Rudy's reputation, to a large extent, was justified. And Trump has just made them into blabbering idiots. I don't know. And he didn't need this. It was the stupidest thing in the world. I mean, you're sitting there. They had this unexpectedly high inflation number. You had a terrible market, and Lindsey Graham comes in there and shits all over their message. I mean, he might be the MVP of this cycle. He really might.
Yeah, or a Democratic mole. I've talked to people this past week in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, California. Every one of them says, there's no question the abortion issue is cutting. Inflation and the economy are the most important issue, but abortion is cutting more than a little bit everywhere. And for Lindsey to highlight it this week was, as you say, a great gift to Democratic candidates all around the country.
So let me say something about the way political strategy works. So you take a poll and you say, tell us what's most important issues, and people will say the economy, inflation, all right? And abortion will be such and such. I've always viewed that's not the proper way to look at it, because, of course, the economy, inflation is a huge issue to people. We're told, and we know this, every time somebody goes to the gas pump or the grocery store, they're reminded. However, people are not really sure that the Republicans have a better answer, or that there is a better answer, how much Biden is to blame. I mean, it's a kind of confusing issue. Abortion is a clean issue. If you vote one way, you'll have the right. If you vote another way, the right will be taken away from you. So it's a little bit, I'm always skeptical of these rankings of issues, because if you ask someone in my home state of New Orleans, do you think the humidity in the summer is a big issue? People say, yeah, it's hot and humid in the summer, but that's not going to drive voting behavior. I know it's a little bit of an extreme example, but this idea that we rank issues by voters' responses is not totally valid, because there has to be a clear policy distinction. There's a clear policy distinction between, you know, choice between Republicans and Democrats. I don't know what the Republican position is on inflation, to be honest with you, and I don't think they do either.
Yeah, they don't like it.
Even more, yeah, they don't. Well, I don't like it either.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, in two key states, Michigan and California, there's an abortion question on the ballot, a referendum. And I'll tell you the importance of that, James. I think that could mean the difference in as many literally as five or six House seats, at least four or five House seats. And that might be decisive. But anyway, we'll be, you know, Ben, by the way, Ben Wickler is going to be a great guest. Okay. James, you're across the pond in London, where all eyes are focused on the Queen and the new King. Tell us about it.
Well, to channel my inner Edward R. Murrow, this is London. All right. So just to give our listeners a context, I'm at the Duke's Hotel in St. James. I'm literally maybe 400 yards from the palace, and you can't walk on the streets now. If you go to Piccadilly or St. James or any of the places, and I don't know where people are going, they're blocking off places, but, and this is a crass analogy to make. I mean, of course, she's 96 years old. She died. It's a little bit like Mardi Gras. I mean, the streets are being blocked off. There are restraints on the side of the road. I mean, it's really kind of an amazing place to be. And all of the shops, like at Fountain & Mason, which is one of my favorite stores in the world, they've had all black in the display window saying, out of respect to Queen Elizabeth, we're going to leave this up for an indeterminate amount of time. And that's the same thing if you go to all of the, like, men's toiletry stores on Jermyn Street. The merchant class loves the monarchy. So I happen to be in the context at my family reunion in County Monaghan, which is right on the border with Armagh in Northern Ireland, which was the center of the Troubles. And there's a little, you know, and I was in Dublin. people like the Queen well enough, but they're not that broken up about anything bad about the British monarch in Ireland. I can promise you that. But she seemed like she really tried to put the Britain's best foot forward. Now, I think she's being remembered fondly. Macron had the best line. She told it to the British. She was your queen. To the rest of the world, she was the queen. And when you said the queen, you didn't think they were talking about the Queen of Sweden or Denmark or Netherlands or anything. You knew who they were talking about.
Hey, James, our guest is the chairman of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, considered by many the best party chair in the country. The Badger State is deeply purple with a big Senate and a governor's race coming up. Ben, it's good to talk to you. If we had this conversation 12 years ago or 6 years ago, a few days after Labor Day, you'd have said, boy, the Democrats are ready to beat Ron Johnson. You know, he's weak. And then every time he seems to come on strong with a slashing, burning campaign at the end and win. Why do you think it's different this time? Why can Mandela Barnes win?
The huge difference between right now and 2010 and 2016 is that at this point in the race, in both of those years, about a third of Wisconsin voters did not have their minds made up about Ron Johnson himself. He kind of kept his head down in the Senate. If you were paying attention, he said all kinds of stuff. But frankly, he did change after that. In the 2016 election, he was supposed to lose. He came back from the dead after a $20 million cash infusion from a couple of billionaires. He then passed a special tax break that netted those two people $215 million. And I don't know about you, nobody I know got a $215 million tax break. This was tilted towards the ultra, ultra wealthy. And as an ad that's currently on the air in Wisconsin points out, he also gave a tax cut to himself. So he kind of showed his true colors, whose side he was on. And now he's talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare, and he's against negotiating lower drug prices. He just is out for himself, his wealthy donors, special interests, and against the middle class. And we've been communicating about this so intensively that only 9%, less than 1 in 10 Wisconsin voters at this point, doesn't know what they think about Ron Johnson. So it is a sea change from the previous election cycles. Wisconsin has seen Ron Johnson for who he is, and they don't like it.
Ben, he's a terrible senator. I certainly agree with that. And I think actually a lot of senators, including some Republicans, would. But you know what the Johnson playbook is. He's going to paint Mandela Barnes as a left-wing Bernie bro, crime-coddling Medicare for all. And I saw in that University of that Marquette Law School poll that 41% of Wisconsin voters don't really know that much about Mandela Barnes, even though he's lieutenant governor. So you know it's going to be a slash and burn, sleazy campaign. That's worked in the past.
Those attacks are already on the air. He's bringing everything he's got. You can tell he's desperate because he's grasping at straws at this point. The key thing that Mandela Barnes has to do and that he is doing is to actually explain not just where he stands. Of course, he supports public safety and supports law enforcement and wants to make sure everybody's safe in our state, but also point out why Ron Johnson's doing what he's doing. There's an ad with Mandela and he says, it's that time of year again, they're gonna try to make me look dangerous because they know I'm always going to bat for you. And he's actually hitting baseball after baseball as he says it. But his point is, no matter where you live in Wisconsin, no matter what your background is, almost everyone, working families across our state, have more in common with each other than they ever will with someone like Ron Johnson, who is out of touch, self-serving, and on the side of the ultra, ultra wealthy who bankroll his campaigns.
And Barnes has backed off the Medicare. Barnes has backed off the Medicare for All and some of the other positions that they're going to criticize.
He's running on like bringing down the cost of prescription drugs. This is a very common sense Wisconsin working families oriented campaign. And it's his positions are pretty similar to Tammy Baldwin's, who you might remember won in a landslide in 2018. The contrast here is not a kind of left versus right so much as somebody who understands working families. As he points out all the time on the campaign trail, his dad was a third shift UAW auto worker. His mom taught public school, and he understands how hard families have to work. Ron Johnson, meanwhile, was set up with a giant company by his billionaire father-in-law and has been shoveling tax cuts to people who own big corporations, which is frankly, not many Wisconsinites.
Ben, I'm going to turn this over to James. One final question. The governor's race, Tony Evers, the incumbent, that's equally tight right now. How does that differ from the Senate race?
The striking thing with Tim Michaels, it's almost the reverse in terms of public awareness from the Senate race. In the Senate race, everyone knows and loathes Ron Johnson. They're now meeting Mandela Barnes. In the governor's race, people know that Tony Evers goes to bat for people like them. If you ask in polls, does he care about people like me? 40% say no, 54% say yes. He's actually introduced himself to the state and they know where he stands. He paves their roads, he gives, you know, funds tax cuts and invests in small businesses. Tim Michaels is an unknown quantity for most people. And what we have found is that when people see the videotape of him, and it's—I want to underscore—it's actually seeing Tim Michaels say this stuff. When they see Tim Michaels saying on tape that he does not want exceptions for rape or incest in the total abortion ban that he completely backs, when they see him saying that gay people shouldn't be able to go around outside, he said they can leave it in their homes. When they see him talking about stuff like letting teenagers buy AR-15s without background checks or waiting periods, he's so extreme and radical. And our governor is just Mr. Common Sense, wakes up, does the right thing every day. That's a contrast that really works for us. And I think if you look across the country, as well as in Wisconsin right now, people can believe it because they've seen it with their own eyes that there are some Republicans, the extreme fringe of the Republican Party, President Biden calls them MAGA Republicans, who are just out of step with the general public. That's who Republicans picked, a full-on Trumpist extremist to be their candidate for governor. And that's not what Wisconsinites are looking for.
James Carville.
So you have a justified reputation for being one of the best state party chairs and running one of the best state parties in the United States. Assume that one of our listeners, and I hope I'm correct, decides they're going to send $1,000. Tell them where to send the money to and give us a general idea of what you would do with that $1,000. What kind of return on investment would a donor get by sending $1,000 to the Wisconsin Democratic Party?
What a delightful question. So
I thought you might like it.
It's right down the middle, Ben. It's right down the middle.
Yeah, right. Let me tell you something, bro. You come on this goddamn show. We're going to knock it down with a
So, dear listener, you're getting out your phone. You're going to wisdems.org/donate. wisdems.org/donate. And you see the $1,000 button, you're hovering over the $5,000 button. And what I would say to you is that when you contribute right now, that helps us in this final period where Republicans are trying to confuse voters about how to cast ballots, what their voting rights are going to be. We have one of the strongest voter protection operations I think the country's ever seen, certainly the strongest we've ever had in a midterm in Wisconsin history. We will be working individually with voters, making sure that local clerks actually follow the rules to make it possible that every vote will count. Wisconsin elections over and over come down to a couple of votes per precinct. 4 out of the last 6 presidential races here came down to less than 1 percentage point. Our governor's race in 2018 was 1.1 percentage points, or as I like to say, a Wisconsin landslide. These are super close elections. And when it gets down like that, you got to have your message, you have to have your candidate go everywhere, but then you have to get the mechanics right of making sure people know exactly where and when they can go to early vote, of finding out if there's some error on their absentee ballot envelope that they can go in and cure that ballot. We have a 100% follow-up rate with any incoming, either through our field team or for people calling our voter protection hotline. We need to be ready for Republicans to try to topple an election that they've lost. And that final stretch, it's like they call the last mile problem in telecommunications. If you don't actually close the deal, you can lose an election in a hyper close state like Wisconsin. So that's what you're investing in. And it could make all the difference from the governor's race that we need to protect voting rights in order to be able to win the presidency in 2024 to the Senate race that could determine the majority, whether Mitch McConnell can block future Supreme Court nominees or maybe get us the 52nd vote that we need to codify Roe versus Wade and restore reproductive freedom in our country, to down ballot races. The last thing I'll add on this, Republicans so gerrymandered our state legislature with an assist from Republicans on our state Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court that we are fighting off a GOP attempt to grab supermajorities in the state legislature. And by investing in our state party, you support the work on every level of politics at once.
Well, you convinced me.
WISDOM.org/donate. You can donate right now, James.
So, you know, we don't have great differentials in between the Senate and the gubernatorial candidates. And at what point, how much difference do you think, I'm trying to frame this correctly, if Barnes gets 52%, then that almost means for sure that Evers wins. What's the number at which one or the other gets it that it carries the other one in?
So the interesting thing is that in previous years, there's actually been huge differences between the Senate and the governor's races. The biggest one was 2018. There was a 10-point difference because the Republican running for Senate, by election day, everyone knew to an absolute certainty that she would take away their protections for people with pre-existing conditions. She would attack healthcare and shred healthcare. And we knew it came down to a single vote in the Senate. So that was a landslide. The governor's race was much, much closer. This time, I think they're much more likely to be very close, in part because, you know, Governor Evers and Mandela Barnes serve together and have the same record of delivering for working people across the state. Also because this question of an abortion ban, Wisconsin has a ban that was passed in the year 1849. And it has, again, no exceptions for rape or incest. And suddenly, Republicans are saying, hey, this is in effect. All clinics, all hospitals that provide abortion care have shut down those services right now. The governor is suing to overturn that ban with the Attorney General Josh Call, whose race is important too. Tim Michaels says that the 1849 law passed before women had the right to vote, and you can tell. He says that's an exact mirror. That's a direct quote of his position. So that's happening in Wisconsin. But meanwhile, Lindsey Graham is here pushing for a national abortion ban. So if you think that people should be able to decide, you know, when and whether to start a family in this country, you've got to win the Senate race and the governor's race. And this is motivating voters who are, frankly, coming off the sidelines in every part of Wisconsin right now. I think these races are going to look pretty similar because of the very specific giant attacks on our freedoms that Republicans are perpetrating at this exact moment.
I figured you'd send one of those contributions to Lindsey, but go ahead, James.
I'll turn it back to Al. Generally, Democratic pollsters and campaigns are telling me that from the start of the summer to Labor Day, they've seen between a 3% and 6% improvement in the bottom Democratic line. Is that comport with what you've seen in Wisconsin?
That does. And the biggest reason for it is that the enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats, whether people say they are fired up to vote, that has completely disappeared. And you know, you can see that in special elections around the country. We can absolutely see it in Wisconsin. That said, we didn't have our Senate nominee in the beginning of the summer. Our primary was August 9th, and we didn't have the Republican gov nominee. So in a lot of ways, this election started on August 9th, right as the kind of rubber met the road on Democrats showing what they're made of, passing these laws that deliver on our values, and Republicans going fully off the deep end in trying to attack freedoms that people have assumed were rock solid for the last half century.
All right, Alan. Ben, with all the gerrymandering, there's only one competitive U.S. House seat, potentially competitive. Ron Kine is retiring. Republicans and expert analysts like Dave Wasserman are saying this is leaning Republican. You have any chance to hold that seat?
So I think we have a shot. And I will also say, if this is the year that it might be, the first congressional district, Paul Ryan's old seat, it's now the underlying partisan makeup is similar to Wisconsin's third congressional seat, slightly red tilted. The Democratic candidate is named Ann Rowe, and her stickers and billboards say Rowe is on the ballot. She is running a 100% crystal clear race to restore the freedom to make decisions about how people can use their bodies that people counted on. So that might be a sleeper. But in the third congressional district, the more people tune in, the better off we are. What we can see crystal clear is that when people find out that Brad Paff, our candidate, he's a multi-generation farmer, grew up on a dairy farm in La Crosse. A colleague once said he bleeds manure. This is a guy who understands rural Wisconsin like nobody else. Versus Derek Van Orden, who was at the insurrection. He was on Capitol grounds watching people storm the Capitol. He's currently on probation for trying to bring a loaded gun on a plane. His biggest claim to fame in the district, which he moved to, is that he went into a library in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, that noted liberal bastion where there was a LGBT book display. And he got so mad and started just lighting into this teenage library intern. She felt threatened. He then checked out every single book from that display in order to make sure no one walking into that library could see what they had on display there. After that news came out, people started sending donations of LGBT books, so the Prairie du Chien Library is, I think, the best stocked LGBTQ book display and section in the state of Wisconsin. This guy is a complete mismatch for one of the purplest districts in America. And when people know him, they don't want to support him.
I'm going to throw one more, and I'll turn it back to James. We had a guest on last week from Michigan, and we asked him what happened to the Republican Party of George Romney, Bill Milliken, and others, and it's now dominated by Trump crazies. The same thing is true in Wisconsin. Going back a longer time, Mel Laird, Bill Steiger, Tommy Thompson. This is a party now that has turned hard right. What happened?
It's kind of stunning. And if you talk to old line Republicans, I mean, we have former Republican county party chairs who are now signing up with the Democratic Party. It's a little bit like, I was just reading something that said like 50% of the Republicans in the House who were there before Trump have either retired, gotten defeated in primaries, or lost in general elections. It's almost a total turnover. And part of this is the Trumpification of the GOP, but part of it goes a little deeper. Scott Walker, Ron Johnson, the kind of Tea Party wave, hugely, hugely supported by the Koch Network, the Bradley Foundation, this far-right foundation in Milwaukee. The biggest funder of the Stop the Steal protest is Dick Uihlein, who, you know, lives right on the border of Wisconsin and Illinois and is a huge funder for Republican Party operations here. It's a radical fringe that's caffeinated by this network of right-wing talk radio hosts who just goose their listeners to flood Republicans with calls if they refuse to do the impossible, like decertifying the 2020 election, which, believe it or not, has become a major issue in Republican primaries here. Will you go back in time and overturn the last election? They've lost their way. And they've lost their way so much that they've also lost touch with a state that's in its bones is still pretty pragmatic. It just wants to, our state motto is forward. We just want to like actually move forward and get things done. And Republicans can't decide if they want to go back to 2020 or to 1849. Whichever way you cut it, that's the wrong direction.
Or maybe Joe McCarthy. James, we have time for one more question before the chairman goes to check all those $1,000 boxes that have come in.
Mr. Chairman, not so much a formal question, but observation. I have really strong connections to Wisconsin. I was just in, I'm in London now. And I was just in Ireland for a family reunion, and I saw the house that my great-grandfather was born in County Monaghan, who immigrated and ended up in Wisconsin, where he was an officer at the end of the war in the Union Army and moved to Louisiana, was a classic carpetbagger. So I have great connections to your state. And I always think about it, laugh. My dad was a college boxer, and you're probably too young to remember this, but the University of Wisconsin was the kind of Notre Dame of college boxing of the Yankees back in the 30s, 40s, and maybe early 50s. And all he could talk about was going to Madison for a college boxing match in February of how cold it was.
Look, we have cold winters and warm hearts here. This is a state where there's a tremendous amount of community, even with all the polarization, even with the divide and conquer tactics Republicans have brought to our state. Walk into any bar, and we have a lot of bars in our state, and people will buy you a drink and get to know you. It's a great place to be, and we just want to restore the soul of our state.
Ben Wickler, I'll tell you how much in the tank we are to you. We've gone through this. We know you have to go. We've never once mentioned the Green Bay Packers after last week.
Things can change. We've demonstrated that politically. We'll demonstrate that this season.
Ben, you're a great guest. Thank you. Good luck, and we'll be back in touch.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks so much, guys.
Good luck to you. If I can help you, let us know, please.
Okay, James, now the questions from our always, always attuned and smart and insightful listeners. Zella in Los Angeles wants to ask you, why is the Democrats or President Biden are not addressing immigration? They're giving the Republicans talking points to hammer on their platforms all day about immigration.
Well, you know, it's an issue. And I think the idea to say we don't have immigration out of crisis, not a problem, is not the right thing. There is a problem. It is an issue. And the problem is we live in a country that people want to come to. Right? That's why people are showing up, because you have a strong job market. And I'll just make one more point. If you take a mother, you know, 31-year-old mother with a, you know, 7-year-old and a 4-year-old from Guatemala that walks 500 miles to the border, that's a motivated person. I'm sorry. That person is not a villain. And they don't, you know, it's a problem, and it's a problem caused by prosperity in America. If you want to drop immigration, then have an unprosperous country. But it is a problem. We obviously, it's a work in progress. We can do better. We got, you know, asylum laws have been there. It is a complex and complicated issue. But I don't think it's anything we need to run away from. And by the way, people like the idea of immigration. I don't think we should. I love immigrant people. Just love them.
Well, every single piece, every study, every piece of data shows that immigration helps the American economy. You know, ask your friend Mitch Landrieu if you could have rebuilt New Orleans after the hurricane without immigrants. Would have been impossible. Mike Bloomberg has noted that the American economy would go into a tailspin without immigrants. You know, and I think, frankly, we would have done better the last couple of years if we'd had more immigrants, despite the tight labor market. But, you know, Republicans are demagoguing the issue.
How many roofers in New Orleans or Houston you think were born in the United States? I'll give you a good guess. 3.
That many?
I don't know. I'm trying to be cautious here, Albert.
Kevin in Vashon Island, Washington, says, can you share some practical advice about how to balance what we read in the news with some semblance of hope that the problems of today and tomorrow will be solved? To what degree is it better to be blissfully in the dark versus staying attuned to an onslaught of depressing, disturbing news over which we have no or little control? Well, Kevin, first of all, there is some bad news out there, and people need to know about the bad news. I mean, the storming the Capitol on January the 6th, denying that the that we had an honest election, which we did. That's bad news, which you need to know about. And I agree, there's some negativity in some of it. We had Steve Kotkin on talk about Ukraine and Russia 2 weeks ago, and his advice was, don't watch cable news. Well, I think that's probably a little bit of a reach. But, you know, you can be selective. You can find, I think, well-informed news that has, sometimes it's negative, and a lot of, in a few print organizations and a few broadcast organizations. So Kevin, you know, you have to be more selective.
Yeah, you know, and it's every time, you know, in every period you have good news and bad news. Again, right now, two best pieces of news I know is child poverty is down 59% and the Ukrainians are getting back territory. Could all this reverse tomorrow? Of course it can. And, you know, having terrible inflation problems and, you know, we had a terrible day in the stock market and we have political divisions and democracies at risk. But there's also things to be, like, hopeful about. And, man, when you're sitting here in Britain and you think about the country when the Queen had a coronation in 1952 and where it is today in 2022, it hadn't been a great 70 years, and maybe justifiably so. But, you know, things change. I mean, the screw of history turns, and we got real deep problems. We've had some remarkable accomplishments. Yeah, I just hope we can get this crime thing back under control that we had for a long time.
And the beginnings, at least, of maybe addressing climate change like we haven't before.
Yeah, we've never done that before. That, you know, and once you start something, you know, the most important step in any journey is the first step. And thanks to Joe Biden and Senator Joe Manchin, we've taken the first step.
Yep. Kelly in New London, Connecticut says, Evan.
That's where the submarine has come out of, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Kevin McMullen was endorsed by the Utah State Democratic Party as a way to unite cross-party unity for the midterms. McMullen is a former Republican, now an independent. How effective will this endorsement be in encouraging other independent races across the country to unite Democrats and anti-Trump Republicans, James?
So Utah is a really kind of different state. I mean, it's a Republican state. Don't get me wrong. But they don't like Trump.
Right.
And one of the where people made a fool of themselves, there was this kind of thing that Mike Lee was a kind of thoughtful conservative.
All right. And he was pretty far right, but he was, I think he went to, you know, some prestigious university or something. And
His father was Solicitor General.
Yeah. And people were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt on everything. He's no better than Ron Johnson. He's just another non-thinking, reflective, extreme right-wing asshole. And he's in trouble because I think people in Utah see that. I actually like going to Utah. It's all they say is a great town, great city. I've spoken up at Utah State. I've obviously been up there in Park Cities and everything. And they are a conservative people, but they don't like Trump that much. And Mike Lee, I think Mitt Romney more fits the you know, direction of that state by far than Mike Lee. But boy, everybody wanted to say nice things about Mike Lee at one time. It's like Bill Barr, you know, a Rod Rosenstein. Shit.
Steve in Crumpler, North Carolina. I got to find out where Crumpler, North Carolina is, James.
I'm going to combine that. North Carolina, John Crumpler was, I know him, I remember. I know.
I'm going to combine that. Two questions. Steve in Crumpler and Henry in New Orleans both asked similar questions. The Moore versus Harper decision, that's the one the North Carolina legislature is bringing that says basically courts and anyone else has no say in the gerrymandering or determining election results. Steve says, just might seal the deal against democracy. And in the hands of a court that had already, the Supreme Court, gutted voting rights, overturned Roe, as well as turning on the corporate faucet to fund politicians. And Henry notes that this would give them the sole power to construct congressional districts, and ask how much of a net loss it would be. It would be humongous. If I think you can make a case that it would mean, I don't know, 20, 25 House seats. And what it is, it's an outrageous abdication of the rule of law. The idea that state Supreme Courts have no say in state constitutions. I mean, these people who love to go back to the founders, I mean, it was on a federal level, but a separation of powers, and with one of the three powers checking the other and checking both. This and conservative lawyers and scholars like Michael Luttig say this is an indefensible, destructive move. The case is going to be argued in October, and I want to tell you there's a lot at stake, James.
Yeah, you know, again, our friend Mike Lee, and I'm pretty sure, fact check me if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. He said democracy is not the goal, liberty is the goal. Well, to them, liberty means it's making as much money as you possibly can, with as fewer taxes and as fewer regulations as you possibly can. And I think there are five people on the Supreme Court, maybe six, that agree with that. There's nowhere in the Constitution is the word democracy written. So who cares about that? What we really care about is to allow corporate America to rape and plunder the country with as lower taxes as possible, pollute as much as you want, pay people as low as you want, and return as much as you can to your shareholders. That is the ultimate goal of the Supreme Court, and a majority, a huge segment of the Republicans in Washington. And people have to realize that. They don't give a shit about democracy. Get out. That's not their goal. That's not what they're about.
James, Teddy in Durham, North Carolina, big Tar Heel contingent writing in today.
Oh, yeah. Well,
asked, does Sherry Beasley have a chance against Trump's pick, Ted Budd?
Hell, I think if it continues the way it is, not only does she have a chance, but in bottom of my, we have in the North Carolina guest next week, so please, and Albert tease his guest. But I don't think Sherry Beasley is any worse than 50-50 at all, based on a lot of different metrics. And, you know, Morgan Jackson told me after 2020, by the way, Morgan is a friend of mine who's a kind of number one Democratic operative in North Carolina. He's the governor's guy. He was a state party chair. He was the whole thing. Just people got underestimate our chances in 2022. And I went out there, and I said on this show, I met her and her husband and her children, and this is one impressive candidate. And Bud, he won't show up for anything. And he got like a, you know, to the extent it matters, I don't know how much an editorial in the Charlotte Observer matters, but it's traditionally been one of the better papers in the country. And I mean, they were just blistering on it. So I not only do we have a chance, I don't think we're any worse than 50-50.
Yeah. Ben in Mission Hills, California, asks, what's the likelihood that since Trump was illegally holding secrets regarding details of foreign countries' nuclear capabilities, that a foreign government would target, assassinate him to keep out of him out of office? Maybe I've read too many spy novels. Yeah, you probably have, Ben. I don't. That's not what worries me about this. I think, interestingly, you ought to read Jim Fallow's latest breaking news newsletter. He has a long section from a former top national security official on the Espionage Act. And there's a section of the Espionage Act, I think it's Section D, but you can check that, that basically says that it is a crime for an official to knowingly refuse to turn over secret classified information that could harm the United States or help an enemy. By definition, that's what classified information is. And I think there's no question that Trump on that alone is culpable.
So, but you're saying you don't think there's a chance he was trying to sell this?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just okay. I'm talking.
Clarify your position.
No, the question wanted to know if there'd be an effort to assassinate or go somebody to go after that information. I think that's too spy novelish.
No, I don't know
But no, I don't know what he wanted to do with it, but it wasn't benign.
This is my question about that. Give me a non-catastrophic explanation for what they were doing.
A benign one.
Is there any now you can say, well, whatever. I cannot think of a non-catastrophic outcome of them having this information, having it all, people going in and out. Anna D'Orazio, good God, read that story. It actually came out of Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Some friends of mine had been pushing this and telling me about this for like seven, 8 months. I have no idea why the Times and Post didn't do it.
Tell us again what it is, James.
It's a woman of pseudonym. She claims she was running the Rothschilds, all right? And they have pictures of her, Lindsey Graham and Trump. And she said, as best that most people can determine, is a Russian spy. And she was hanging out at Mar-a-Lago. And the Post-Gazette broke the story. You can guess who has been pushing this story, but I've been hearing this for like 9 or 10 months, and it's unbelievable. And it was just a giant con. That when, but the thing about con people, they all get conned. What was that movie with Robert Redford, and they had the bookmakers in Chicago, and they conned them all?
I love that. Yeah, I'm having a secret moment.
And they all con artists get conned. And Anna D'Orazio, and I think she's back in Russia now, I don't know where she is, conned the whole thing, and they were all lining up, and, you know, they're such white trash, every one of them, and they thought they had some member of the aristocracy. They were falling all over. You got to read the story.
I will.
It's like, got to make a movie of this, you know.
Lynn, who is near Mount, I should know this because I've been in Maine a fair amount, but I don't, near Mount, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Katahdin. Anyway, it's K-A-T-A-H-D-I-N. I apologize, Lynn, for not knowing how to pronounce it, but Maine is a fabulous state. And she wants you, James, this is going to be a tough one for you. This is going to be a really hard one, so you got to get ready. She wants you to please weigh in on Rick Scott's 11-point plan as it will affect Social Security and Medicare. I see conservatives constantly complaining about their small Social Security checks, but never vote for a Democrat. So could you tell us and tell Lynn about the Rick Scott plan?
So if I said to our viewers or to you, name the three most unsympathetic people in American politics, the question would be, is Mitch McConnell 1, 2, or 3? All right? Because he is simply the most unsympathetic human being that in American politics. Or if not, maybe Trump beats him or Lindsey Graham. I don't know. I actually feel sorry. Rick Scott, the decision to make Rick Scott the chairman of the Republican Senate Committee because he had a lot of money and he thought it would be nifty, And of course, he and McConnell are publicly feuding. McConnell's trashing Rick Scott's candidate. They're back and forth. Rick Scott is, best I can determine, according to record, is, well, should I call him a Medicare criminal? I'll leave that up to you. I think he paid like $1.7 billion in fines.
When he ran the health care company. Right?
Medicare over. Of course, he's a state where you probably have the highest percentage of people on Medicare. But, you know, he beat Senator Nelson, who's a good friend of mine, who I love, by like 10,000 votes. I think Rick Scott is a giant asshole and a giant drag on the Republican Party, and is a man who's such an asshole, he can actually give you 2% sympathy for Mitch McConnell, which is quite an accomplishment.
But just for a minute, tell Lynn about this 11-point plan he has.
Well, his 11-point plan is to sunset Social Security and Medicare, and is to tell, if we get Bob Greenstein to talk about this, that the hotel maid doesn't pay any income tax, okay? Which is true, but the hotel maid pays. Medicare tax, Medicaid tax, Social Security tax, beer tax, property taxes are hanging on to her. If you live in New Orleans, she pays 10% sales tax, everything else. So Rick Scott thinks that the working poor, or we've seen this staggering 59, we don't have enough children in child poverty. Let's have more. That's his answer.
Right.
I'm a moral man. We need more children going to bed cold and hungry. Oh, Jesus. What a jerk.
That waitress or that maid who's making $20,000 a year is paying at least almost $3,000 in payroll taxes. Now, hopefully she gets the earned income tax credit. But Rick Scott he doesn't want anybody who's making $3 million a year to pay more taxes.
Rick Scott he and Ron Johnson don't want to pay nothing.
Keep those questions coming. They're really good. I apologize to those of you who I didn't get to the questions this week. We'll try to get to them next week. But keep writing in to @Politicon and tell us where you're from. Nothing to do. Not content, Barr, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who I once said had a spine, I apologize for saying that, he does not, and the Washington U.S. Attorney Jesse Liu, trying to curry favor for a promotion, indicted Craig for supposedly lying about his representation. It took a jury recognizing this fraudulent case only 5 hours to acquit Craig. As Berman says, this was all about politics. Some people who should have known better, like liberal commentator Rachel Maddow, failed to adequately report and assailed Craig. And Skadden Arps, the supposedly distinguished white shoe law firm where Craig was one of their top attorneys, dropped him like a bad habit. Never mind the rule of law or presumption of innocence. He was scapegoated. I've known Greg Craig for years. He's been a valuable public official. Berman's revelations, though I wish he had told us all about this 2 years ago when he was fired for objecting to this partisanship, are a total vindication for him and others, and a searing indictment of Barr, Rosenstein, and the Skadden Law Firm.
Oh, is it? And by the way, what they tried to do to John Kerry, they wanted to prosecute him on some 1799 law, and they did everything they could. I mean, these people are criminals, okay? There are criminals, the whole lot of them, and there was no Team Rudy and Team Normal. They were all criminals, literally most every one of them. And you're right, and that book is just stunning. The way that they used the Justice Department in like unheard of ways. And it's Greg Craig, all right? But the John Kerry stuff was like, gee whiz, man, these people have no bottom. They have nothing. And then when it all goes to hell in a handbasket, then Barr tries to douse himself in perfume and body powder so he doesn't stink as much. And it didn't, in my mind, didn't do any good.
If it looks like a pig, sounds like a pig, smells like right. A pig, what is it, James?
So one of, I think, in terms, and you mentioned that Laura Tyson is a regular listener of our show. And Laura, I hope you listen now, because there was a story in the New York Times by a journalist named Jason DePearl, who's been around for a long time. But I don't know if I know Jason that well, but I think he's a very reputable journalist. And the story said one of the most stunning facts about modern America that I can imagine. Do you realize between 1993, let's see, what happened in 1993? In 2019, there was a 59%, a 59% drop in child poverty, all right? And I had to listen to this shit during the 90s about Clinton's small boy policies. And, of course, what they found out was these targeted strategies of which people like Laura, Bob Rubin, Roger Altman, all right, even Larry Summers, had this obsession with the working poor and children as poverty. They set into motion one of the great accomplishments of modern America. Because the whole thing used to be, yeah, they did Social Security and Medicare, and they drove elderly poverty down, but I now listen to this crap from the Atlantic and the New Republic and all of the everything else, but we hadn't done anything about child poverty. Wrong. We have done something about it and done just something. We've done a hell of a lot. And it all, and people built on it, and of course, Obamacare, the health insurance stuff helped a lot. But the idea that you can have targeted programs that are designed to help people can be effective is now shown to be, well, effective. And this, to me, as a Clinton person, is one of a major, staggering, breathtaking accomplishments of modern America.
Well, I think that's right. I think Clinton deserves a lot of credit. Barack Obama deserves a lot of credit. And a lot of legislators deserve a lot of credit. As the incomparable Bob Greenstein, a big report fan, what they did, which was very, very smart, they expanded these programs, whether it was the child tax credit, earned income tax credit, Medicaid, to cover not just the poor, but the working poor and people even in the lower echelons of the middle class. And to make sure they don't fall into poverty. They've been remarkably successful. And,
a lot of people deserve a lot of credit for a lot of things. George Washington is known as the father of the country. Bill Clinton is the father of the reduction in child poverty, period. End of argument.
I just think there are a lot of fathers, but that's okay.
Abraham Lincoln, again, he was the one that started it.
And, the
crime rate started in 1993.
I agree with you totally, but the earned income tax credit was actually started by Russell Long in the 1970s. That's the single greatest reducer of poverty. I couldn't agree with you more on things that have happened, but, you know, it didn't just begin in the 90s, although that Jason DePearl data is fascinating.
But it's not fascinating. It's uplifting. It's moral. It is a great moral statement by the United States that we reduce child poverty by 59%.
I agree. Just got to go a little bit further with the next Congress. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, SleepMe, Magic Spoon, and Raycon in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them. When you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.